I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Mark Hillman.
And this is Emmett Hillman.
And we're coming to you from the historic and beautiful Germantown Cricket Club outside of Philadelphia.
Which is almost as historic and beautiful as the Tennis Podcast.
Well, thank you very much to Mark and Emmett for their intro there, coming from just outside of Philadelphia, a city that is on my would like to visit list. I've heard very good things.
Yeah, I want to run up the steps like Rocky.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I want to walk around listening to the streets of Philadelphia.
Yes, I'd like to do that.
Maybe we could do both at the same time.
You might want a more upbeat energy, David, but sure.
Yeah.
You can stroll up and down the steps, a sort of a lollop.
I'm happy with the Rocky music.
Okay. Well, anyway, thank you very much to Mark and Emmett for your intro there. Hello, welcome to this brand new Listener Questions Tennis Podcast special. Happy birthday to my mum.
Oh, happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Catherine's mum.
We don't usually do birthday shout-outs, do we? It just came to me, Monday, October the 25th. Unless, mum, you're listening to this not on the day of its release, in which case, belated happy birthday. we have got guest editor Dave Courtine for this week's podcast. Dave has come up with some of his own questions. In fact, his 16-year-old daughter Rose has helped him sift through the questions that we've had in from various bits of social media. He says, Rose is a bit of a tennis stato. She's always correcting me on who won and where, and she even has this reputation at school. In RE, where they were discussing equal rights for women, very different RE classes to the ones I had. The teacher was asking about tennis giving equal pay at the Grand Slams, then stopped and asked Rose if this was just true at Wimbledon or at all slams. Having listened to the Billie Jean King editions, Rose not only knew there was equal pay, but remembered when each slam went with equal pay. We like Rose, don't we?
Yes, immensely. Like Dave as well, who's Dave actually works in tennis. He runs leisure clubs, but he staged and stages tournaments at the Shrewsbury Club in the UK.
Place of my birth.
Yes, and I think I might have mentioned
not the tennis club.
No, I think I might have mentioned it on the show a few years ago when I attended one of his events, and he puts on great events. And he's a massive supporter of the Tennis Podcast. And did you know? Did I ever tell you that I first met Dave Courtine when I was about 12? Did I ever tell you that?
Nope.
Yes. Yeah. No, you have, because isn't there another part to that story?
Up.
Yeah, he worked at a holiday camp in East Anglia, which I was a guest at, and he was one of the sort of sports organisers, and my sister had a massive crush on him.
Oh, this is ringing a bell. Yes.
Although I remembered it as you had a crush on his sister.
Ooh, that's a twist that I didn't even know about myself.
Has Dave seen you play tennis, David?
No.
Has he seen that fearsome serve boom down?
No.
Before the net?
He hasn't. No. It's it's a challenge match that we have promised to enact in the future, though.
Okay.
And I have met his daughter, and she's lovely, and his whole family are lovely, and they're, well, anyway, delighted to have them as our guest editors.
Well, his challenge for you today, David, is a bunch of very hard-hitting questions, I have to say. Dave and Rose have had their editorial hats on. They've done us proud, as all our guest editors always do. We've got some great questions here. Some of them have come in through social media or various channels that Dave and Rose have sifted through, as I say. So, are we ready to crack on?
Yes,
we are.
Okay, the first question I would like to hit you with, courtesy of Dave and Rose, is thus. Will we look back and think that Emma Raducanu's phenomenal US Open success did more damage than good for her career? She now heads into 2022 with a huge target on her back and with incredible scrutiny from the press, despite only playing in 5 tournaments on the WTA Tour. Had she lost in the first week at the US Open, would she have been able to build her career in a more structured way and ultimately have been more successful? Not that that's a massive, sweeping, hypothetical-based question or anything, but who would like to tackle that one first?
Well, we do love a massive, sweeping hypothetical here on the Tennis Podcast, don't we? I do, anyway. Look, I think she'll be fine. Personally, my expectation is that she will be fine, that there will be bumps in the road, that there will be moments when she finds it all a bit much or makes a decision and can't understand the degree of scrutiny or has a run of bad results. This is human nature. It is not all going to go in a straight line from anonymity to worldwide success and global fame. And this is an incredible story to start her career, one that I didn't see coming, nobody saw coming, and which has just changed tennis. It really has changed tennis, certainly here in Britain. It's given it an injection of life, which, well, I think we're all thankful for people that work in the sport, and everybody who watched her run was inspired by and enthused by. But it is interesting as a case study as to whether it will cause problems for her that wouldn't have happened had she had a more gradual development. Personally, I think you take what you can get, you just run with it, and I think she will be fine. The other ones that have had this sort of emergence are people like Boris Becker winning Wimbledon at 17 out of nowhere. Suddenly he is just so recognised. I do get a bit concerned by the reaction, the sort of instinctive reaction to any quotes about her right now. I was reading this morning, Tracy Austin had said something on Tennis Channel about her coaching, about Raducanu's coaching situation and how she thinks she should rehire Andrew Richardson and have a familiar face, etc., etc. Suddenly that's a headline. I just calm down, everybody. Calm down. I mean, it's she's had one match since winning the US Open, and I think everybody just can dial that down a bit. But I think ultimately, I think this will be the launch pad for her. She may have a period of maybe even a year where not much happens, and I just think that's all right. But I think she will end up having a fantastic career, injuries, health permitting. That's my expectation.
Yeah, I think as the question touches on, and as you've said there, David, there's no doubt that there are aspects of what Raducanu has done by winning the US Open that probably will make the road ahead a bit harder in terms of the scrutiny and just the opinions out there. But there's also lots of ways in which it makes the road a lot easier for her in terms of she's suddenly going to be getting into tournaments that she doesn't have to grind her way towards. She's suddenly going to get access to the best coaches in the world. You know, she's in that situation at the moment. It sort of, maybe she hasn't got choice of whoever, but it certainly feels like that. It certainly feels like who she wants, she will probably get. And of course, there are cautionary tales about players who've had a great launch into the sport and haven't been able to build on it or have been burdened by that, whatever. But in terms of her career, she's already had a career that lots of players would envy and want to trade theirs for. So I think it sort of really depends on your expectations of her career. Just, yeah, I mean, this next year could be less successful, I suppose. But that doesn't mean that her career is going to be bad. I still think she can build, even when people want things to happen straight away. I think she understands that she can build. And after she lost in Indian Wells, she had, I think, the best perspective of anyone, pretty much, recognizing that it was going to take time, saying she needs to cut herself some slack. So, look, everything she's done so far has put her in a great position, and I sort of trust her and have belief in her. She's intelligent. She knows herself. She knows her game, I think.
Yeah, I feel the same. I understand the caution and the trepidation sort of implicit in the question. There are, as you say, there are enough cautionary tales that we should have caution in discussing her and predicting anything in particular for her. And you know, obviously Jennifer Capriati is the most alarming one in terms of female teenage success ending up probably being to the detriment of her overall happiness. But there was an awful lot else going on there beyond success on the tennis court, and we're not privy to everything about her setup and her life and her personality. But I see enough significant differences that I don't worry about that sort of scenario. Now, that doesn't mean, as David says, there aren't going to be bumps in the road. There may be massive bumps in the road. But I agree with both of you. Overall, I don't think there's enough cause for alarm to think that winning a Grand Slam could be anything other than a great thing. So long as we are careful with what we expect and predict from her, I don't see any chance that she'll look back and think, God, I wish I hadn't won that US Open in 2021. I think that is highly unlikely. But that doesn't mean that, you know, she's not going to have a target on her back and there's not going to be a bit of second season syndrome where players start figuring her out and making a point of, you know, exploiting her weaknesses and exposing weaknesses and all of that. All of that will happen, but that's part of the process. That is what happens. And I back her to figure it all out. So yes, I appreciate the caution, but let's not go too far down the sort of party pooping route, I suppose. It's also okay to be excited about and for Emma Raducanu, I think. So we've all agreed on question one. You can't keep going like this, can it? Question number two, folks, from Dave and Rose. The top 10 men's seeds at Indian Wells were all 25 years or under. Given the dominance of the top 3/4 players over the last 10 years or so, have we now skipped a generation? Has the Djokovic, Federer, Nadal era meant that other players aged 25 to 32 years of age? You can just say Grigor Dimitrov, Dave. has it meant that other players aged 25 to 32 don't know how to win big tournaments? And just as they have the chance to step into the big three shoes, they're being outperformed by the next gen group? It's a great question. I mean, in short, Dave, I think, yeah. I think the last 10 years have been brutal for that group of challenges, and we're now at the point of too much baggage accumulation. That's my feeling.
I mean, I'm not going to stand for the Dominic Thiem erasure of the 25 to 32 age bracket. He is in there. He has won a big title. He has proved himself. But certainly, I think the overall point is
we're
extremely
valid.
We're looking
at Nishikori, Dimitrov, Raonic.
Yeah, look, I think there was a time when the big four were dominating, and people recognised that players from their generation were not going to get a look in at winning the big titles. Or maybe they'd have one chance, like a Burdick or a Songa or a Ferrer. So I think most people, myself included, then fell into the trap of thinking, oh, well, it'll be the next generation. It will be Dimitrov. It will be Nishikori. It will be Raonic. But actually what's happened is it's been another generation skip, and now we're at Medvedev, Zverev, Tsitsipas. And arguably that's taken longer than you would expect. And now you've got Sinner and Alcaraz and Audrey Aliassime sort of pushing through as well. So I think, yeah, I mean, the answer to this question, I think, is yes. We are at a point where I do not expect Nishikori, Raonic, Dimitrov, those players, to win big titles. As you said, too much baggage, too many younger players who I think are better than them now.
Imagine 2014 Matt having to listen to 2021 Matt say that Nishikori will never win never win major titles.
Catherine, imagine 2012 us saying that Dimitrov would
Well, go
not...
on then. Cue you, David, making the case for Dimitrov's big moment still being yet to come.
Well, one of the things that interests me is I think our assumption is it's just a question of timing and mental baggage build-up. But maybe they just weren't as good. Maybe Raonic
Well, of course they weren't as good as the big three.
No, but what I'm saying is I think the assumption is that had they just come along in a different era, that they would have won more. And whereas if you... And there's this sort of hope that because these much, much younger players have not been beaten up by these all-time greats, that they will be able to cope and end up breaking out and winning. And that I certainly make that same assumption. I always have that it's just a question of poor timing. But I always remember Dimitrov playing Wimbledon 1 year and losing to Richard Gasquet. And somebody in the commentary box with me was just saying, you know, look, maybe he's just not quite as good as you think he is. And I think that there is something to that, because it looks so good, because it looks so extravagant, and we always judge talent. I was thinking about this when we were talking about Cameron Norrie the other day. The assumption is that Cameron Norrie isn't as talented as maybe Dan Evans or certain other players who have more extravagant strokes. But isn't that just a definition of what talent is that maybe I'm falling short on, for instance, because it's appearances that I've tended to judge over the years. And I wonder, I'm quite interested in the fact that Medvedev is 25, so he's just on the cusp and he has broken through. But will the others, Zverev seems to me to be kind of holding on to his scar tissue and keeping it at bay just about, because he's got this crazy sense of how good he is and how destined he is. Not crazy, but extreme, let's say that. And I do think his game is dangerous to a lot of players, but he still hasn't done it. Now, will he? Will Tsitsipas break through? Is there another generation about to be skipped? I'm quite interested in that.
I think that's very interesting in terms of were they not good enough. I suppose some evidence we have is that, you know, Dimitrov's closest moments to winning a slam, he did lose to Djokovic at Wimbledon, Nadal at the Australian Open. You know, he played great, great tennis, but he ran into all-time greats. Raonic lost a Wimbledon final to Andy Murray. How many times have we seen Kei Nishikori beat everyone else at a slam and lose in the quarterfinals to Novak Djokovic? I mean, it feels like sort of every slam that there's been in the last 3 years that has happened. But I take your point. But I think they did show themselves to be better than everyone else. They just often ran into three of the greatest of all time. And I think that is a question of timing.
Mm. Yeah, I feel the same. And I feel like, you know, I feel like Andy Roddick is a really good example of timing, isn't he? Because, you know, he's the first to say, look, yeah, I just, you know, a guy called Roger Federer happened and I just, you know, I couldn't beat him. And he snuck in there and won his slam and reached world number one just before Roger Federer secured his stranglehold on tennis. He just snuck in time and got those achievements under his belt. 6 months later, he might never have achieved those things, and we'd be looking at a completely different career, completely different person now, most likely.
And he still wrung every drop out of his career.
Absolutely.
He so nearly took out Federer at his best, really, once or twice at the, you know, he got mm-hmm. very close in 04 and 09 at Wimbledon. But you're right. He is an interesting example. Yeah, I agree.
Mm. And I certainly agree. I really agree with your analysis there, David, about sort of reframing what we consider to be talent and potential. But I do think that's perhaps a lot more applicable to Dimitrov than Raonic or Nishikori. Not that they're not, you know, they don't have aesthetically pleasing elements of their game, but. I certainly, yeah, I think we probably have been skewed.
We were seduced, Catherine, really, weren't we, back in 2012? We were.
Yes.
I only need to watch one point of Dimitrov now in 2021 when he plays a beautiful point, and I still find myself thinking possibilities.
Yes.
I just love the guy. I can't help it. I love watching him. I think he's a lovely fella.
Dave Rose,
in
answer to your question, Matt and Catherine were seduced by Grigor Dimitrov in 2012. And it's been a rocky road for all of us since then. Question number three. Four teenagers who have had breakthrough years over the last 2 years. Raducanu, Fernandez, Goff and Świątek, brackets. Okay, I know she's 20 now. Put them in order of how they will finish in the rankings at the end of 2022. He's asking us to do predictions. How is this snuck in there? We need to put rules on our on our guest editors in future. His order from high to low, incidentally, is Fernandez, Świątek, Goff, Raducanu.
Go on, Matt.
Oh, thanks.
that was sly.
This feels like the sort of, I don't know, your top five favourite books question or albums. Oh. It just changes. It sort of depends on the mood. Today,
separate show on those.
Today, right now, I would go Świątek highest. I think she's backed up her breakthrough season well. You know, she maybe hasn't had the standout result, but she's been consistent. She's still won titles. Her game translates seemingly to all surfaces. I think she's doing well. She's at the top for me. The other three is I find really, really tough. But I'm gonna say Goff, Raducanu, Fernandez to follow. Goff, I was thinking, you know, that there was a time this season where we were predicting quite big things for Goff. There's probably been a time where we've done that for everyone. But, you know, she's not had bad losses this year. I was looking back over her record. She's lost to, you know, Osaka, Pliskova, Svitolina, Jabeur, Kerber, Stevens, Bencic, Krejcikova. These are the players that have beaten her since, you know, kind of the start of the year. And Savastova, I think, a couple of times. These are not bad losses. She's beating most of the players she should beat. And I think she is improving her game. She's still got some weaknesses. The forehand is probably the main one, the serve at times. But I like her fight. I like her competitive instincts. I think she's, again, got a game that translates to clay, which I think is important. That's my worry about Fernandez and Raducanu. What might they do on the clay? And that's quite a big portion of the season. There's quite a lot of points there. What I've said about Goff certainly applies to Fernandez as well in terms of liking her competitive instincts. She maybe doesn't quite have the target on her back like Raducanu does, just simply because Raducanu won that US Open final. But she's got a little bit more tour experience, but I think Raducanu might have another big result next season, and sort of those points might carry her ahead of Fernandez. But yeah, it's really tough to separate those three. I feel pretty sure about Świątek, and the others are very close. And it's exciting having three players like that.
Yeah, I definitely feel the same about Świątek. I feel like she's won a slam, and She's backed that up massively. She's had the most consistent slam season of anybody, I think. Fourth round or better of all the slams. You know, that's really significant, I think. And yeah, you know, she hasn't won another one, but she's still only 20 years old. And to have that consistency, I see is really significant for Świątek. So she's the one I feel most secure about of those four. Look, there are none of those I worry about in terms of being flashes in the pan or not having basically really, really good careers. But in terms of next year, taking Świątek out of it, because I'd probably put her top. I mean, look, Coco Gauff is the youngest of those, let's remember. She's been on our radar the longest by far, but she's also the youngest. She's 17 years old. And I do think perhaps she might need to take a... From what I gather from people that know better than me, she does need to make some technical changes to her game. And sometimes when that happens, you have to take a step back before you can take those steps forward. So I think it's possible that if she does that, if she addresses the forehand and I think the second serve as well, that she could take that step back next season. I don't know. I'm speaking about technical stuff, which is a bit beyond my brief, but if I had to say now, I would probably go Świątek, Fernandez, Raducanu, Gauff. There you go. David.
I had written down exactly the same list as Matt has got, in the same order. And for the same reasons on Świątek, on Gauff, I was probably the one at the head of the queue of the three of us really thinking that she was going to have a breakthrough moment this year. Not just a year, because I think this has been another good year for her for the reasons you outline. And they were the ones that contributed to me thinking she was going to end up having a really massive run at a Grand Slam. And that hasn't happened. But whilst she's lost only to really mostly good names, so a couple of the recent score lines, the heavy defeat to Sloane Stephens, the heavy defeat the other week to Paola Badosa, which was 6-2, 6-2, those sort of score lines alarmed me a bit. I mean, maybe she's running out of gas a bit, but she was schooled at the US Open by Sloane Stephens, and that was a jarring sight to me. Not that Stephens doing well is a great surprise, but that was a performance and a matchup that just took me by surprise. But I've got her second because I think her appetite is so there for all to see. And I think it means that she's just going to keep on turning up week in, week out and improving and finding ways. And I think her game is because she's a bit more, she's just tour hardened in a way that Raducanu isn't going to be for another 18 months. And Fernandez, I think, I've got in fourth, and I feel she feels like the one that I'm always going to end up slightly forgetting about, like Sofia Kenin, which feels wrong because she's another one who just keeps on turning up. But I think maybe this next year might be a little bit more tricky for her just because she doesn't have the natural win easily moments with her game. I think it's harder work for her. But I think she's going to have more really good seasons to come in the future and just still be a factor. I'm just not sure it's going to be in 2022. Raducanu, I think you're right. I think she's going to have... There's going to be a lot of furore about her generally, but she's going to have some moments which just put the points on big time on fast surfaces. I could see her doing really well at Wimbledon again. I could see her doing really well at the US Open again and tournaments where it's a bit quicker. But I don't think you're going to see it just go in a straight line for her next year. It'll be ups and downs.
The clay is a very good point, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about players here that we've never seen play on a clay court, right? I mean... I know Leila Fernandez will have played tour events on a clay court. I honestly can't think of one that I've watched.
I think I watched her play Kvitova at the French Open. I have a memory of that. She's certainly got a bit more, vastly more experience than Raducanu, considering Raducanu's experience is naught.
I've played more clay court matches.
Yeah, I mean, that is going to be, yeah, absolutely fascinating next year. But, yeah, it's a cracking question. I mean, they're all cracking questions.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
The next one is from at Miss Jess on Twitter. She says, I assume it's a she, apologies if not, the podcast's always been great, thank you very much, but I think you've stepped up another level with Matt being a permanent fixture. Agreed, Jess. He's like the perfect middle level head. Let's not think too much about what that means about our heads, David. So my question is, which player do you think could use a Matt? Someone knowledgeable about the sport and a calming influence.
Well, I've got down, for men, I've got Stefanos Tsitsipas.
Ooh, good luck with that, Matt.
I think could just do with some straight talking from a very calm,
what would you
wise,
say, Matt? What would you say?
Head.
This is your audition.
What would I say to Stefanos Tsitsipas?
Yeah.
I can't get through this question. This is mortifying. I don't have the credentials. I genuinely have no idea.
But for some reason you've been given the job with Stefanos Tsitsipas. You're in the locker room with him now. No, you're in the loo with him. He's having a bathroom break.
I'm texting
him. He's called you from the loo.
Well, I'd say sort your fucking shoes out would be number one. Get some shoes that fit you.
Yep. Number two.
Number two would be, I don't know. What do you think? What's holding Tsitsipas back? I think he's got this weird thing where he can't play in the second half of the season.
I think he needs to sort his scheduling out.
Yeah, probably yeah. that actually. That like, I think he needs to schedule like a top player, like back himself more. And
what Matt does with me is, and it's a bit mortifying considering he's 25 and I'm 48, but he calms me down a bit when I'm getting overexcited about ideas that aren't really realistic or sort of, you know, we've already got a plan and I've come up with another three ideas on top of the plan.
I tried to do that for a decade before Matt came along, very unsuccessfully.
Yeah, we used to end up arguing. Catherine, you give me your Tsitsipas one quickly, and then I'll just tell you something else.
I was never.
Oh, okay.
Catherine hasn't been thrown under this bus.
Yeah, the scheduling was for me. But can I just say, when I said at the start of my answer, I've got written down Stefanos Tsitsipas, I've just realised that was for the next question. So the actual answers I've got written down are number one, Denis Shapovalov. So Matt, what would you like to say?
What are you saying to Dennis?
Well, look, I think if we're asking for a calming influence, then yeah, Shapovalov is the one that sticks out. But then he's tried to be calm, hasn't he? He's tried to sort of embrace
calm.
He's
already doing his meditation and stuff.
And that feels like a contradiction to the rest of his game. And he seems a bit sort of stuck in between.
I thought maybe Andre Rublev, you could just tell him to just chill out and stop.
Doesn't matter that much.
Just go and get a hobby or something.
Yeah, I quite like
know,
that.
Stop wanting it so much so soon. I don't know, just go and have a beer or read a book or...
Play more mixed doubles.
Play... Yes!
That went well. He liked that. That was absolutely fun, Rublev vibes.
Matt telling players to play more mixed doubles, that is the influence that tennis needs.
I think Shapovalov actually needs to be told a few home truths, personally. I mean that in a nice way, because I do like Shapovalov.
Do you want to be that guy, Matt? Sitting down, telling
but
Dennis Shapovalov home truths?
Not in a kind of lecture, but I think he needs to listen and stop thinking he knows it all. He comes across to me as if he just knows it all already. It's coming from a good place. I think he's a nice lad, Shapovalov, and I love what he tries to do on court. But come on, some of the people he's been losing to and the manner of them, particularly after Wimbledon, are just not on. This is still junior behaviour.
But if Mikhail Yuzhny isn't getting through to him,
what
he seems pretty straight talking to me. Well, what are you going to say, Matt, that's going to get through to him in a way that Mikhail Yuzhny, who once battered his own head with his racket to the extent that he drew blood. What are you going to say that will get through?
I mean, I don't think Shapovalov would be good. I'm a bit over Shapovalov at the moment.
I'm having a break from him as well.
I've got a woman as well.
Go on.
Arina Sabalenka.
Oh, I feared it would be that.
Well, what are you saying to Sabalenka then?
Well, she does need to calm down on the court. The clearest example is her semi-final against Fernandez at the US Open. She got herself completely stressed out in that match. And this is really hard.
Nothing's more motivating than someone just sighing at you.
Sighing at you and telling you what you're doing wrong and not having any answers.
Great, I'm pumped. Thanks, Matt.
But, you know, in reality, he would do it in such a considered, understanding, soothing kind of way, which he does with us, Catherine, which, again, is rather embarrassing.
I do think Arina Sabalenka could do with some soothing.
Don't you think she's quite a different personality on and off court? Like, off court, she seems really bubbly and, you know, a bit out there, sure. But she seems to have fun off court. And I never get the sense on court that she's having a whole lot of fun.
It's a bit tortured, isn't it?
I think she needs to be shown video of these matches. And maybe that happens already. But she needs to be shown matches where it looks like she's in charge, hitting the ball a million miles an hour. And then she kind of ends up beating herself, or somebody enables her to beat herself by hanging in and making her play that extra three shots in a rally. And you can see the red mist build inside her as she's just so frustrated. And I totally get it, but there's definitely room for improvement there, I think, within her. She could be even better.
It's difficult because you don't want to take that fire away. You know, that is one of her strengths when she's playing well, that sort of overwhelming force that she brings to a court. But it's also her biggest weakness when she's not playing well. And I don't know how you sort of balance those two things out, but I think that's what needs to happen for her.
I'm going to let you off this very, very pointy hook, Matt, because I feel like this question actually segues very nicely into our next question. Not least because David spoiled the next question. But anyway.
I got the answer. Stefano Tsitsipas. Don't know what the question is anymore.
This is from Dominic on Instagram. Who will be the next first-time major winner on both the men's and women's tours? Who have you got in the women's, David?
Paola Badosa. And I know that that seems like incredible recency bias. And I did, look, I hovered over Sabalenka. The reason I went with, I think the common denominator for both the men and the women to my answer was that I see it coming at the French Open. That's where I feel like there's a deep reservoir of players who all can break through there. And on the men's side, Alcaraz, Casper Ruud. I still ended up going for Tsitsipas because he got so close last time, and I also think he's got at least the possibility of doing so at the Australian Open maybe, or at the US Open. But I think the thing with Badosa is I just feel the shape of her strokes are perfect for French Open, and she's getting better and better, and I could see her winning Roland Garros sooner rather than later, maybe next year.
It's kind of amazing when you go down the list of WTA players, how many have already won a slam? Like, there feels like there's lots still to choose from, but there's also lots who have grabbed that first slam. I landed on Badosa as well. Again, could well be a bit of recency bias there, but I just think what we've seen from the other real contenders for this question in some of the biggest matches just slightly concerns me in terms of Sabalenka, as we've discussed. I think Jabeur and Sakkari are absolutely heading in the right direction, but they don't actually win a lot. They don't end up winning the title that often. They have great weeks, but then they sort of just fall short in those biggest matches, whereas Badosa has just won Indian Wells and played a fantastic final against an opponent who demanded her to play that well. And I agree with David in terms of the French Open aspect there as well. We've seen a lot of surprise winners at the French Open for quite a long time now. You know, Ostapenko, Krejcikova, even Świątek. These were not people we were expecting. I think there's opportunity there. And I think Badosa, with her clay court prowess, could take advantage of that. I also like her on hard courts as well. And actually, she did all right at Wimbledon. So I think she's pretty well-rounded. And I agree with you on Tsitsipas, actually, for the men. Again, first half of the year is where he's had his slam runs. He's never done anything at Wimbledon or the US Open. But yeah, I could see him winning the Australian Open or Roland Garros next year.
I'm afraid we might all be in agreement here. I definitely think Tsitsipas. I very quickly came to the Tsitsipas conclusion. In terms of the women, I had to get the ranking up, and I had exactly the same thought process of you going through, like, oh, they've all already won them. And I landed on a short list of Sabalenka, of course, Jabeur, Sakkari, and Badosa. And Jabeur and Sabalenka, strangely, I sort of grouped in the same category of they have the game. They clearly have the game. But Sabalenka has shown us significant question marks over her mentality. And as you say, Matt, but there have been no sort of awful losses for Jabeur, but haven't got the evidence of her doing big winning. And there's more players that have the game than there are players that have done big winning. And I think Badosa has the game, and we've just seen her do big winning. So, yes, it's totally recency bias, but I landed on Badosa as well. But I was tempted by Jabeur.
She was very interesting, by the way, after her run in Indian Wells, and she ended up breaking the top 10. And we had that will she, will, won't she, or has she or hasn't she kind of conversation about that. And she ended up doing that. That she ended up losing the next match that she played against Badosa, and she lost it heavily. I watched that match, and she was terrible for her level. You know, she could not get it going. And yet, she's one of these players that when she's energized and freewheeling downhill, I mean, she's nigh on unstoppable. She was making other good players look really ordinary in the run to that point. She has this injection of pace on the forehand, flicks the ball. She's playing with you. She's playing the game as though she just it's just an opportunity to show how amazing she is, which I personally, it makes me want to watch her all the more. I love every minute of it. I just don't know how repeatable that is when the stakes are at their highest and when you are stressed. Because the moment she got over that line and reached the top 10, I sensed that she showed how much of a weight that had all been on her and how the feeling of nirvana that she experienced just suddenly led to the low afterwards, the down, the emptiness of kind of being just flat suddenly. And I actually think that that may now help her in the early start parts of next year. She's already got that under her belt. Now she can build again. And her game works on kind of all the surfaces. So I'm certainly closer to thinking that she will be part of a mix at some point in my lifetime than I was this time last year.
A mix, just not the mix. Next question from Nick Profit on Instagram. What would tennis be like if there was only one serve? Who would benefit and suffer the most? Would this impact the women's game or the men's game more, if at all? It would surely impact the men's game more because it's a more serve-dominated game. More points, cheap points are won on first serve on men in men's tennis than in women's tennis. And when you reduce it to one serve, you'd have the occasional moment where a player would gamble, and that would be an interesting facet to the game, but basically you'd be seeing a second serve almost all of the time.
Yeah, I wonder whether Nick Profit was Diego Schwartzman's alias, because I mean Schwartzman sort of plays the game with one serve. You know, he is at such a disadvantage compared to most of the other players in the field, and yet he's still
What's
managed
serve like, Matt?
To get I mean, into the top 10.
I can't really picture his serve in my mind. I don't really notice it.
It's a point starter. It really is nothing more than that. I think he hits his spots quite well. He's quite accurate with it. And he certainly, just as he gets the most out of sort of all his game, I think he does get something out of his serve. But he is at a disadvantage, a massive one, compared to other players. And, you know, if you take the serve out, he would be doing better, I believe, even better. His return stats are fantastic. I think sometimes you hear sort of non-tennis people think, well, why is there two serves in tennis? Like, can't pros just get the ball into the court? Like, shouldn't they be able to do that? And yes, of course they can. I think it would detract from the game if you took away the second serve. I think it would take away an aspect of the game, which I enjoy, which is a great returner trying to decode a great server. You know, we've enjoyed Andy Murray against John Isner, or Djokovic against Songa, or Federer against Roddick. Those have been interesting elements to those matches. And I think it would take away variety, which is already diminished. But if there was only one serve, how much serve volley would we see? I think even less. How many net approaches end up off the back of a good first serve, then a forehand, and then you come in. I think a lot of variety comes from the fact that you've got that first serve. I think you'd end up with way more just baseline rallies. And look, that's fine. I enjoy that. I probably enjoy that more, but I like the variety as well. And I think it would impact the men, but also, I mean, it would impact the women. That, you know, Serena Williams' serve, I think, is the greatest serve of all time. If she only had one serve, would she have been as dominant? I think Ash Barty's number one in the world at the moment for lots of reasons, but I think her serve underpins a lot of her success as well and leads to some of her variety, the way she sets up her points with that. So I think it would look quite different, tennis, and I think it would be worse if you just had one serve.
I would like one tournament per year to feature only one serve. I feel that about a couple of aspects to the sport. You know, I wish there was a sort of a themed tournament. And I think that could work. I think the players that I thought of that would benefit or certainly still be just as strong, aside from the ones with very strong baseline games, are the ones that have really reliable actions that can put loads of kick on the ball, who have just great second serves as it is. And I actually think Barty would prosper. I think Maria Sakkari would. Players that can just really do more than just start the point with a reliable serve. I do think Djokovic would be even more dangerous. I think he would have had an even better career if that was the case. I think somebody like Zverev would have be nowhere near as potent personally, because I think he wins so many free points. But I think he could get more wobbly sort of thing. He couldn't do the going full out necessarily on a second serve, I don't think, all the time, the way he's tended to do recently. But I'd happily have one tournament a year and try it out.
I'm very on board for themed tournaments like that.
Still want my wooden rackets tournament as well.
Yes. David Law does the past. We've got a couple more questions. So we might have to go, a little, not quite quick fire, medium-paced fire, please, for our remaining couple of questions. The first comes from Rebsrim/PG22 on Instagram. Not sure what's going on there. What do you think of the electronic line judging that we've had in recent tournaments? Good, bad, irritating, / takes out the faffing, less drama, etc. I mean, I'm all for taking out faffing. As we've established on this podcast, to be honest, I don't have massively strong feelings about it. I think it's fine. I wouldn't sort of campaign for it to stay. I also am not going to march for the return of line judges as much as I feel for them in the sort of the erosion of that profession. I don't think sort of stalling technological advances is the answer to that. I definitely am opposed to video review of a call that is not going to be changed. I find that ludicrous. But I'm aware that what they're trying to do with that is recapture the fun of a Hawkeye challenge.
But it doesn't.
It doesn't. There's no fun to it whatsoever.
No, none at all. It's ludicrous. Get rid of it now. Get rid of it. But it's an acknowledgement that something is lost. We've lost the fun of the Hawkeye challenge. Again, I don't feel that loss too keenly. I'm okay with it. I just find it hard to get riled up either way. It's a rare topic that I am not riled up about.
Turin will be interesting in that way because they're going to have it back. They're going to have Hawkeye challenges during the ATP finals, and that will be interesting to see how that feels after so much time now with Hawkeye live. And it was interesting watching a match with my daughter recently. Sometimes, you know, there might be a final set tiebreak or a match involving one of the British players she really likes, and I bring the iPad over and sit down with her, and she'll watch it with me while she's having dinner. And the thing she said to me in the middle of the match was, "Oh, don't they do that thing with the challenges anymore, and the heartbeat and the sort of, you know, looking at whether it's in or out?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Oh, I really liked that. That was a lot of fun." You know, she's 11 years old, and I thought, well, that's interesting. She's actually noticed that's gone. And I do think it's taken something out of the sport a little bit. It's added something in a different way, efficiency and faff-free and all the rest of it. But, yeah, I do miss it a bit. And the point has been made by a few people that there's a visual element lacking to the line calling. You just hit, you can hear the out call, but you don't see a line judge's arm go out. And I think that I believe is going to be addressed. It certainly needs to be, I think.
Yeah, for various reasons, I often end up watching tennis on mute if it's in the background. And if I'm watching a rally and there's no line judge, you have to wait for the score to flick over to determine whether a close shot was in or out if you don't have that out call, where normally you would just look at the line judge's arm going out or not. So I definitely think they need to add a visual element. I don't know what that is, but, you know, with the electronic boards at the back of the court, maybe they could do something with them. I think that would help. Yeah, I agree. My biggest concern with all this is actually not the impact on a tennis match. You know, I thought I wasn't going to like it, but actually I've been sort of indifferent about it. I don't really mind not having challenges, but my biggest concern is the pathway for umpires. You know, if there are significantly fewer line judges, where are the top umpires coming from? And Dave points out as well that lower down the tours, you know, it's expensive to have Hawkeye Live. How will futures and challenges cope if there are fewer line judges around, if they're not involved on the main tour events and can't make a full,
very good point,
full-time career out of it? So I think there's a reason why we've sort of always had line judges. And if I had to choose, I would probably prefer the previous system of line judges and challenging. It feels like quite a good compromise, that, for me.
Final question comes from Egg Bob Beans. And again, apologies. Which I have almost certainly got that wrong. This comes from Instagram. The sweet spot in a tennis match is when two players play their best at the same time. This seldom happens in the course of a tournament, let alone an entire season. However, there have been occasional matches throughout the decades where both players have sustained their highest level for an entire match. He or she gives the example of Brady versus Sarker in the US Open semis last year. They ask, what are your top five purple patch matches? They say Badosa Azarenka at Indian Wells has to make the shortlist, or is that my recency bias? Well, I actually think there've been a lot more than perhaps that question suggests. I'm going to go full recency bias for this and say a couple that sprung to my mind from this year. The first is Kerber against Sara Cerebes-Tormo at Wimbledon. And I'm sorry to bring that up, David, because I know you enjoyed that match on a bench outside the court.
I enjoyed the sound of it.
David heard it.
Yep. And to be fair, it sounded great. The crowd were wild for it. The crowd knew how special what they were witnessing was. It was just two players toe-to-toe drawing the best out of one another. It almost, you know, it looked like a game. Of course it was a game, but it looked like a sort of computer game at points. It became ludicrous. It was that high level. And it felt rare. It felt really, really rare at the time. So I would definitely submit that. And I would submit, look, I think I'm not sure there exists an example of a five-set men's match where both players have played their best for the entirety of the match, because I don't think that's possible. I think that's not the point of five-set tennis. I'd say probably the closest to it, with the caveat of recency bias here, would be Nadal against Djokovic at the French Open this year. There were huge periods of that match where two of the best players of all time were playing their best at the same time, and it was extraordinary to behold. I know it didn't end like that. I know Nadal was a shadow of what had come before in that fourth set, but for a sustained period and a best of five set match, that was as close as it gets, I think.
I have to say, you've given me goosebumps describing that, because, and I want to go and watch it again, because I have it written down, but the way you've just put it, that is what it was like. I can't remember what was it set three or four that was the tiebreak set. And I haven't seen it since. I just know how I felt at the time as they just, as you say, two titans of the sport going toe-to-toe, playing their best stuff on Nadal's turf, and Djokovic somehow coming out on top. I mean, incredible. I'll actually give you just a... I mean, I got very frustrated after this when I was trying to compile a list, because so often I'll watch a match and we'll talk about it maybe on WhatsApp or talk about it on the podcast, and we'll say they both played their best at the same time. and I never make a note of which one it was. And I wish I had this ongoing list of matches so that I could always refer back to. But I'm going to go back quite a way to 2001 US Open, Pete Sampras against Andre Agassi, four tie breaks, and ahead of the fourth one, they both got a standing ovation before the tie break even started. And that's because it was a bit like the Nadal-Djokovic sets that you discussed. The other one, I'll also go back also to the US Open. So many wonderful memories from that tournament. And I covered this match in 2003 between Justin Henin and Jennifer Capriati. And it was Henin who won it 4-6, 7-5, 7-6. Two very different types of player. Stylistically, visually, in the way they hit the ball and go about their business, but they were both bringing it, and it was, you know, Capriati was such a favourite of that crowd, and we don't have enough vivid memories of her recently in a positive way, but God, if you went back and saw that match, you'd be on the edge of your seat even now, and it's 18 years on.
Matt?
I will say a match we did for Tennis Relived, which was Venus Williams, Lindsay Davenport, 2005 Wimbledon final. Always remember that line Davenport gave you, Catherine, in the interview, saying she knew at the time how good that match was while she was playing it. Just an extraordinary match. I think the longest Wimbledon final. Just an extraordinary level throughout. And then the men's match, which comes to mind, is from the 2009 Australian Open, Verdasco versus Nadal.
Oh, yeah.
That was peak Nadal in terms of his movement and his defence. And yet Verdasco hit about 100 winners past him and still lost the match. You know, Nadal's a guy who brings his best level. You know, he sustains it. He can sustain it over five sets. And Verdasco in that match lived with him and still couldn't quite get it done. There's a banana forehand round the net post that I always remember that Nadal hit. Just a stunning match, and made even more stunning by the fact that Nadal backed it up a couple of days later by beating Federer in five sets as well. Just
Do you know that match finished 193 points to 192? I looked it up actually because I had it on my shortlist as well, and but I'm living off memory there really, because that's 12 years ago and I haven't seen it back since. But yeah, the 100 winners is a great selling point.
We're all living off memory, David. And with that, I think that's a wrap. Not least because I need to head to YouTube to spend my day rewatching all of those matches you've just listed, genuinely clearing my schedule. What a list of questions. Really great questions. Thank Fantastic. You, Dave. Thank you, Rose. You've really done us proud there. I enjoyed that a lot. Any questions that lead to a thought experiment of Matt being locked in a toilet with Stefanos Tsitsipas, I think.
Even if by accident, because I got the wrong bloke.
It's been a morning well spent. I hope you agree. Billie Jean King sponsors Billie Jean, who spent almost the entirety of that podcast asleep on my shoulder until I had to relocate to charge my ailing laptop battery. Sorry, Billie Jean. She's now looking longingly at me from the floor. You're still sponsored by Billie Jean King, so cheer up. Zeus, Scousel, Mousel and Rogue are our mascots. We haven't disgraced them yet this week. Actually, no, we have disgraced them.
Yeah, we're all anyway. Out. Marketa von Droscheva, the prediction killer.
Let's not dwell on that. Let's dwell on Chris Albert-Lee, our executive producer and top bloke. Hello, Chris Albert-Lee. And that's it for this week's tennis podcast. We'll be back, won't we, with another one next week. David's off to Croatia. Happy holidays, David.
Thank you very much. Very much excited.
Yeah. Please do remember the rules about frequency and tone of sunny beach pitches that you're allowed to send. Yeah,
yeah, you won't hear from me for 7 days. Don't worry.
Yeah, great. Okay, thanks very much. Those are the rules. Thank you for listening. Sign up to the newsletter. Leave us an iTunes review. What else can you do? Is that all the things, David? Follow us on Instagram and Twitter and all of those things. And that'll give you the chance to submit questions for our next listener questions special with another guest editor. So thank you very much for listening. We'll be back with another tennis podcast next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.